This week on Your Western Context, economic migrants are costing us almost $400 million. GM is closing its auto plant in Oshawa, and Amarjeet Sohi agrees with pro-pipeline protesters. Also, Trudeau's government stalls a probe into money laundering as a Liberal MP has a gambling problem. This is Western Context, Episode 96, recorded Saturday, December 1st, 2018. Disruptive doublespeak. Hello, everybody, and thank you for joining us for another episode of Western Context. Patrick and myself are back once again this week.
Yes, it's good to be back. We're somehow into December already. November seemed to fly by really fast, so we are now into the last month of the year. And surprisingly, we had news crop up right after we finished last week's episode. So we're definitely going to be talking about that today, especially in a way that the media has not connected the dots.
Yeah, some rather unfortunate news out of Ontario, but we'll get there in just a bit. But if you're joining us for the first time, Western Context is a podcast that aims to cut through bias and sensationalism that you find in the mainstream media and provide all the information and context necessary to put you on the right side of the news. And this week, we're starting off with a Canada story that, you know, you would think would have come together on its own over time. But lo and behold, we're actually just getting some numbers on this right now. And the headline with this was that irregular migrants are on track to cost Canada almost $400 million, Watchdog says. And the Watchdog, in this case, is the Parliamentary Budgetary Officer. And the report that was put out details the cost for each irregular migrant, as the government calls them, who arrived between April 2017 and March 2018. And on average, the cost for each migrant was $14,321 to the government of Canada, otherwise known as the taxpayers. And, you know, those whose cases ultimately are running through the system longer are going to cost the country more money in the long run. And the Parliamentary Budget Officer, the PBO, projects the cost, the per migrant cost, will rise to an average of $16,666 on average for the fiscal year ending March 2020 if nothing else changes. And what this effectively does is this puts the new stream of arrivals into Canada costing an average of $340 million per year. Now, opposition immigration critic Michelle Rempel pointed out at this case, doing some very simple math with this, that at the start of the next fiscal year, this will end up costing the country upwards of $1.1 billion in total. And some have pointed out that the Prime Minister's initial Welcome to Canada tweet was a $1.1 billion tweet, or perhaps the most expensive tweet that was ever issued. And, you know, you can look at it that way, or you can look at it in another way, but I think there is no denying it that it was the Welcome to Canada tweet that set this entire issue off. Now, the migrant issue is one that we've been talking about since day one here at Western Context and filling in all the information when they first started arriving and the media wasn't talking about them, and slowly ramping up the pressure, because when this all started out, it was thought that this might have been just a trickle, but then the numbers were actually released, and we saw that this is actually a huge problem. And when the population was pulled on this, they did say it was a crisis. Now, Bill Blair, the person who is in charge of the border and the former Toronto police chief, called it silly to suggest that a tweet could spur the spike, but he admitted that there are loopholes in the Safe Third Country Agreement with the United States that could potentially incentivize people to cross into the border irregularly. Now, many of the people crossing into Canada are economic migrants and not refugees. And this is something that the media might mention from time to time, but let's have a look at what these are and what the exact differences are. So an economic migrant is someone who is looking for a new country that has a better outlook in terms of either job prospects for themselves, for their family, and the country is generally in a better fiscal or financial situation than that they're coming from. And what this means for them is that they're more likely to get better benefits, such as our healthcare system here in Canada. Now, contrasting this to a refugee is a person who is fleeing a country that is filled with war, or that persons group, whether it's a religious group or an ethnic group, could be potentially also facing persecution as well. So that's the difference between refugees and economic migrants. And most of the people coming into Canada since the start of 2017 have been economic migrants compared to refugees, because we do have other channels to facilitate refugees entering Canada, both through government sponsorship, that is, the government looks after them when they arrive, and private sponsorship, where individuals through a church organization or community organization will look after the people once they arrive in Canada if they are refugees. Now, near the end of the report, a recent trend was highlighted, and this is directly from the report here. It says that CBSA, or Canadian Border Service Agency officers, have identified a recent phenomenon where a claimant enters Canada irregularly and then acts as an anchor relative for other family members. Now, as a result of this, these family members can enter a port of entry and not be considered as irregular migrants. Now, as with most discussion on this issue, the government didn't respond when they were asked about it. And we don't particularly know how many times this has happened or what the government's official stance on this might be, though we can get a pretty good idea of what it could be based on what the government's former actions on this file look like, and also the fact that this government wants to sign on to something called the United Nations Global Compact on Migration. Now, in general, this is an agreement with the UN, and it raises the rights of economic migrants and will ultimately blur the line that used to exist between this kind of migration and the traditional refugee that Canada is known for taking in. Now, this means that rather than looking at what a country needs for its own economic needs in terms of immigration, that the economic migrants and whether or not they want to migrate to Canada will be taken into account first over the own country's economic needs. Now, the compact also highlights a few other things in particular here with this, in that it intends to reduce the risks and vulnerabilities that migrants might face at different stages of migration by respecting, protecting, and fulfilling their human rights and providing them with care and assistance. It'll also strive to create conducive conditions that enable all migrants to enrich our societies through their human, economic, and social capabilities, and thus facilitate their contributions to sustainable development at local, national, regional, and global levels. Now, you would have been hard-pressed to hear anything about this global migration compact before today, but this is definitely something that the government of Canada intends to sign on to, and as with most stuff when it comes to the immigration file and people coming into the country that we've been talking about here on the podcast since 2017, the media doesn't really talk about it initially, but then when the light is shone on it from one area which they may want to cover, that is immigration success story, or a case where they, in the past, as we have said, if you are in any way attempting, and so it seems going into 2019, to limit migration into the country, the media will paint you as a racist. And, you know, here at Western Context, we're discussing the facts, and in particular that involves the United Nations Global Compact on Migration, because at the end of the day, Canadians deserve to know, and that's why we're here talking about this on the podcast, because if we weren't talking about this, you would think that this might just be something that was talked about in the report, and the government might be being a little bit negligent on this fact. But when you look at the fact that the government wants to sign this and that this is something that's going to be coming up as an issue very soon in the United Nations meetings, it makes sense why we're seeing the reaction from this government that we are on this kind of migration into Canada. Canadians deserve to know better. And, you know, this is something we've also been saying here at Western Context for a while. The media willing and whatnot with the border and migration into Canada, this can ultimately become a key issue in the 2019 election campaign if the media is willing, though, as we've already pointed out, that if the wrong kind of dialogue is used or perhaps the wrong view is presented, the media won't hesitate to paint anyone as a racist who thinks otherwise when it comes to migration into this country.
And as we talked about a couple of weeks ago, the amount of money that the government is going to be propping up the media sector with could have an impact on the oversight that the media does have on the federal government's actions, especially on this particular issue. Now, this is something we've been talking about for almost 2 years since we first started up Western Context back in January 2016, and it's pretty baffling to see that this is such a huge issue still 2 years later, and the fact that not really much has been done to kind of solve the issue and to stop the bleeding of money that's been having to go towards this. I think at this point, when you see that 4 out of 10 shelter spaces in Toronto are being taken up by recent migrants and refugees, just the amount of money that places like Toronto, but other places as well, have been having to spend on security issues and hotels to house refugees, the fact that this is causing so much money, it's baffling that the government doesn't seem to want to do anything about it. And the fact that they're looking at signing the UN Global Compact on Migration is it almost seems like it's going to be compounding the problem.
Yeah, and you know, we've also talked about this before. Modern media is driven by the amount of people that they can get to read or watch the story, especially online today. And if it's not something that can bring those clicks in, then it won't be covered. And this is one of those stories where if they can paint it in a way and they're saying, "Ha, opposition says that these people coming into Canada are costing taxpayers $1.1 billion," and that's a fairly shocking number to most people. Sure, they'll cover that, but they're not getting into the actual details here, in particular the cases in Toronto, Montreal, and other cities that you've mentioned, and in particular the UN treaty that is being talked about, which is a big deal and everyone should be aware of. So
yeah, it's almost like the media is going for the clickbait headlines, but they're not actually delving into the real issue and why it's happening, and they're not holding the government to account on that issue.
That's right. All right, so as we mentioned at the start of the show, we're going to move on to Ontario next and Canada in general. So what do we got with that?
So shortly after our show last week, I believe it was either Saturday night or early Sunday morning, both of us were stunned to learn that General Motors had announced that it was closing its plant in Oshawa, Ontario, which will eliminate almost 3,000 jobs in the town of roughly 160,000 people. That's located 60 kilometers east of Toronto. Now, there's no product allocated to be produced at the plant past December 2019, which is a likely date for the shutdown. Now, while early reports theorized that a shift towards electric vehicle production was the cause of the Oshawa closure, as well as several plants in Ohio, Michigan, and Maryland in the U.S., GM has said that it's a lack of consumer interest in cars. Now, GM announced Monday that it would shutter 8 plants, one in Canada, 4 in the U.S., and 3 outside North America by the end of 2019. They say that this is a global restructuring that will slash 6,700 production jobs and save the company $6 billion U.S. annually. And it says that it will invest the cash in electric cars and self-driving vehicles. Now, the Oshawa plant, which made the Chevrolet Impala, the Cadillac XTS, and previous generation Silverado and Sierra trucks, contributed 6% of total Canadian auto production. Now, U.S. President Donald Trump was very critical of the GM closures, and he said on Twitter that the 25% tariff that's been placed on imported pickup trucks and commercial vans for markets outside North America in the 1960s has long boosted U.S. vehicle production. He also mentioned that he's going to be looking at new auto tariffs to further protect U.S. industry, as well as looking at cutting subsidies for GM. He said on Twitter, quote, "The U.S. saved General Motors, and this is the thanks we get. We're now looking at cutting all GM subsidies, including for electric cars." So I think we can see that this response from Donald Trump is pretty in character for him, that he's wanting to protect U.S. industry above all else and to tariff as much as he can to do so. And we've seen this in a lot of different areas over the past year and a half, where he's placed tariffs on industries that he thinks should be doing better. So this could be bad news for Ontario auto workers, as GM, as well as Ford and Chrysler, have significant number of factories supporting thousands of jobs in southern Ontario. So if more tariffs are being put on autos, we could see a further decline of the auto industry. Now, the federal government has been rightly accused of not standing up for industry and Canadian jobs in the past, most notably in the oil and gas and natural resources sector. However, it appears that Trudeau is willing to go to bat for the auto sector. At Friday's ceremony to sign the new version of NAFTA, the free trade agreement between the United States, Canada, and Mexico, known as USMCA, Trudeau urged Trump to reassess levies imposed on Canadian imports back in June. Trudeau, in a speech, called the plant closures a heavy blow to workers and their families. And with Donald Trump right next to him, he said, quote, "Donald, it's all the more reason why we need to keep working to remove the tariffs on steel and aluminum between our countries." Now, it's doubtful that Trump will agree with that sentiment, as he's already thinking of adding more tariffs, not removing them. Now, you can make a reasonable-sounding political argument that Liberals in Ottawa and Toronto are to blame for a General Motors announcement on Monday that it's closing its plant in Oshawa. Prime Minister Justin Trudeau talks about the middle class at every opportunity, but he hasn't really done much to support them. He's ignored repeated urgent calls from the business community to match Donald Trump's cuts to the corporate tax rates. And while Barack Obama was president and Stephen Harper was prime minister, Canada had lower corporate tax rates, which gave us a key competitive advantage and boosted industry in Canada. Now that we are at a disadvantage, companies making a low-margin product, like cars, need to look at all costs, including corporate taxes. So we shouldn't really be surprised, then, if they decide to keep plants open in Michigan and close them in Ontario. Now, Ontario Premier Doug Ford took to Twitter to assure the workers and families affected by the Oshawa closure, saying, "My promise to the workers and the families impacted by GM's decision to close their Oshawa assembly plant, we're going to fight for you. We're going to stand by you. We're going to help you get you back on your feet." Now, Trudeau took a different tack. He praised Unifor President Jerry Diaz for his union's role with auto workers. He said, quote, "We'll be supporting Canadian auto workers and their families affected by GM's plan to close its plant in Oshawa next year. My thanks to Jerry Diaz and the team from Unifor for the meeting and discussion today." And opposition leader Andrew Scheer took pointed criticism to Trudeau. He said, quote, "Thousands of workers in Oshawa will lose their jobs when the GM plant closes. Just as he has in Western Canada, Justin Trudeau is failing to protect Canadian jobs. Canada is becoming a less attractive place for investment." Now, Scheer met with workers outside the GM plant in Oshawa early Tuesday morning. He said, quote, "This is an award-winning plant that has been recognized for its efficiency, its productivity. The workers here are recognized as being the best at what they do." Now, surrounding all this, we should note that there is a by-election in the district of Leeds, Grenville, Thousand Islands, and Rideau Lakes, east of Oshawa and south of Ottawa. Now, this will be taking place on Monday. No, this is regarded as a pretty safe conservative riding, as the late Gord Brown had held the riding since the 2004 election. The margin of victory could have a very telling story on the impact of Trudeau's policies on this critical area of Ontario coming into the fall 2019 election.
This whole story regarding General Motors and Ontario in particular, I think, is something that everybody in Canada should be taking eye of and taking notice of, because, you know, we sit here in Western Canada, and this, of course, isn't our industry to that runs our side of the country. And, you know, you can look at Ontario and you can see how big of a powerhouse these industries are there. And, you know, when it comes down to it at the end of the day, this is a big deal, 2,800 workers at least, and that's going to have insurmountable side effects for the economy surrounding Oshawa as well. People will move out, things will change there, and not for the better. And one thing that people have been talking about online in particular with this is that we need to take note of what this government's response is, because the government has received a lot of criticism out west here over the past weeks and months, on particular the pipeline file. And just the amount of jobs that have been lost in the West on the energy front in the last number of years, you know, many times more than what's happening in Oshawa, Ontario. And that doesn't at all diminish what is happening in Oshawa, Ontario at all. But it's something that the people in particular online and in various communities in the West are going to be paying attention to. And I think that's also something that the government needs to be aware of. I'm not sure if they are. And also, I think we also have to look at the media on this too, because most of the media is based out in the East. And with that, you have a very similar focus on the East. And, you know, there were some rather poor and really bad comparisons this week in the media about how when the auto industry does well, in the East, the resource industry in the West doesn't do well, and vice versa. But that's not entirely true. With the right economic situation going on, the right economic policies, both industries can do well, and Canada as a whole can do well. So there's also some really shoddy reporting going on that side of it, too.
Yeah, that's true. There's been a lot of false conclusions being drawn about this story. I think when the news first hit, there was a lot of sensationalism and hand wringing about the, you know, how the sky is falling and all that, and how dare GM leave Canada and that sort of thing. But when you actually look at the issues that surround this and take a look at the policies by the most notably the previous Ontario Liberal government, but also the federal Liberal government, and how they have sent signals to businesses about their competitiveness, it has really given the answers as to why GM decided to close their doors in Oshawa. And I think once we look at the reasons surrounding it, it all becomes more clear.
Yeah, it definitely does. And, you know, and anyone who is watching what was happening with the U.S. as soon as the president was elected in November 2016, you saw the stock market start going up. And, you know, that really should have been a wake-up call for this government, is that we have said it time and time again that the economy in the modern era runs on signals, and most of those signals are psychological. When you see a stock market doing well in the U.S., that's a good sign to investors and whatnot, and investors are going to be more likely to want to invest money in places. But when you have corporate tax rates that don't compete with the Americans, and you throw the fact of the Canadian dollar in, then you start seeing a cooling off of investment in Canada as well. And that's also been proven over the last number of years as well, that investment is actually leaving Canada on that. And while not entirely the reason for the shutdown of the GM plant, it did have a factor, if not a side factor, in it. So.
Yeah, and another huge factor is definitely the USMCA agreement, which was just signed, of course, earlier this week. And the fact that it was signed, but there's still huge tariffs on autos as well as steel and aluminum, could have a huge factor on businesses from America doing business in Canada, especially when their goods have to be tariffed to get back into the U.S. So that could have a huge impact on it as well. And it really just comes down to a combination of the signals that are sent by the governments and what they're able to do to entice businesses to actually stay.
That's right. Job number one needs to be removing those tariffs that are on steel and aluminum. And we're going to talk more about pipelines and in particular that in just a moment. But first, just a reminder about our Patreon page and how you can support Western Context. You can find out a lot more about that at westerncontext.ca/support. We offer three tiers of support. For $2 a month, for the price of a cup of coffee, you help us remove the bias and sensationalism that we find and remove in the news and media. And for $5 a month, at the price of a sandwich, you can continue to help us do that. And you can also have your name read out on the podcast if you want. And for $10 a month, you can become an insider and gain an insight into our work and gain pre-release access to our show notes and production throughout the week. And if you want to make a direct one-time PayPal contribution, you can do that too. More information on all of this can be found at patreon.com/westerncontext or westerncontext.ca/support. All right, so we're going to move on to the Alberta story this week. And as we mentioned, you know, every time a federal minister comes out here to Alberta, it appears they're being protested this time. And on Friday, Natural Resources Minister Amarjeet Sohi, who is from Edmonton, was addressing the Edmonton Chamber of Commerce. And with the last federal cabinet visits to Alberta, both Bill Morneau and Justin Trudeau, he was met by protesters. And Sohi's response was certainly an interesting one. He said, "We agree with them. We are all supporters of the pipeline because we know that we need to get our resources to non-US markets so we get proper pricing for Alberta's oil. And the amount of money that we're losing is completely unacceptable, and we understand your frustration. We share that frustration." Now, that's fine to say that, but what was actually happening outside? It wasn't just a protest in support of the pipeline. The protesters were once again protesting Bill C-69, which overhauls the way that energy projects are reviewed in Canada, making it a lot more harder for those projects to get off the ground. And this is a notorious case of doublespeak, because what we see here is that the minister in question, Amarjeet Sohi, effectively said, "We agree with you. We agree with what you're saying, the protesters. But what's actually happening is that the protesters are urging the government to turn back on Bill C-69. So it might have been a miscommunication between Sohi and the media, or maybe something that wasn't printed properly. But what ultimately this sounds like at the end of the day is that Sohi believes as well that Bill C-69 should be turned around. And I don't think any minister, let alone the Minister of Natural Resources in this government, probably believes that. So I'm willing to perhaps chalk this one up to erroneous media reporting on this. But at the end of the day, it's a notorious case of doublespeak, because what we're seeing doesn't match what's actually happening. So while this was happening, Sohi also ordered the National Energy Board to study whether pipelines are being used to capacity. And he wants the board to ultimately determine what steps should be taken if they aren't. But economics answers this question quite simply. We know up to $80 million is being lost a day to Canadian revenue from this oil price differential, which at points throughout the last month has ranged between $40 and $50 for the price of our oil, and compared to the price of oil that's sold elsewhere in the world. And there's no deadline set for the NEB study. It's not known when it'll start, what the results of it will be. And all you need to do is look at the amount of economics, in particular, of what's happening in Alberta and in Western Canada with this, to know that, yeah, there's too much oil. The oil companies are even saying this, that there's too much oil. Even the Alberta NDP government is saying that we have too much oil sitting here in Alberta and we need a way to move it out. So what exactly is happening and what exactly is going to result from this NEB study isn't clear at this time. It just seems like another way for the federal government to dither and not get anything done. Now, what also wasn't really reported with this was that while in Edmonton, Sohi handed out $10.7 million worth of government money for EPCOR's proposed solar farm. Now, this project will need to receive approval from the Alberta Utilities Commission, as well as the City of Edmonton, and $1.9 million of this project will ultimately come from those who pay for electricity in the City of Edmonton as well. Residents nearby on the southwest side of the city would prefer that the project be placed on less valuable land than what EPCOR is planning to use for it. And just for comparison here, this solar farm will generate roughly 12 megawatts of power and be used to run the local water treatment plant. Now, by comparison, in 2016, Alberta's coal-producing power plants had a capacity of 6,287 megawatts, while wind production in southern Alberta was slated to produce around 1,467 megawatts of power. Now, compare that to the 12 megawatts that this solar farm will produce. It'll basically be enough to run the water treatment plant and then feed a little bit of what's left back into the grid. So it's a $10 million project for really not much extra power compared to what the existing power generation capabilities of the province are. And this is precisely what we said at the outset of the story. This is a case of doublespeak where actions, of course, speak louder than words. Because what we have here is we have a story where the Minister of Natural Resources says he agrees with the protesters, he agrees that pipelines should be built. But of course, the main thing that's happening at this announcement this week was the announcement of a new solar farm. And we know that that is the direction that the government in Ottawa ultimately wants to go. And, you know, that's why I think why we're seeing another NEB report rather than any concrete action on this. And basically what this means is that the NEB report needs to happen. And then they're also waiting for a report on the Trans Mountain pipeline before they determine how best to appeal that decision that was made as well. So a bit of stalling going on, but that's of course not what was talked about in the media. It was mainly the protesters and the like, and, you know, credit to these people for going out there to protest. I think the protest was out at 7:30 a.m. when he was giving this speech, and it was rather cold out at that time as well.
Yeah, I mean, this is just another case of a politician that's talking a good line out of one side of his mouth, and in the other one, he's doing something completely different. The fact that they're giving out money to an energy company, no less, to be able to create a solar farm that's only going to produce, if we do the quick math here, it's probably about one out of 900th the amount that is actually in total produced by both coal as well as wind. So that's not really something that's going to have a huge impact on Alberta's energy grid, and likely they'll still have to import a lot of that electricity from other provinces. I think Alberta receives a lot of its electricity from the hydroelectric dams in BC, and the fact that the government money is going towards an energy company and not towards trying to actually solve the problem in the first place of the energy companies losing money because of the decisions to not be able to make pipelines and to not get the resources to market, I think is the bigger story on this. And the fact that the media hasn't really connected the dots on this one is definitely very interesting.
Yeah, quite interesting. And, you know, I think the natural follow-up question for the minister would be, what part do you agree with? Do you agree that Bill C-69 is bad, or do you just agree that the pipeline should be built? And I think if you agree that the pipeline should be built, then the next question after that is, why do we need another NEB review to talk about oil capacity if we know that there's a capacity problem and the pipeline should be built for that reason? Simple questions that aren't being asked when you think about it. So, all right, firing line. This one is actually a BC firing line story, but it's a big one, and we've talked about it before. So we knew this would be back, and here it is.
Yeah, so way back on episode 38, now this was just over a year ago, I detailed a report that unveiled the dangerous threat that organized crime from China has on BC residents, as well as our economy. Now, in the year since that report came to light, the government has promised to do something about it, but the problem has just since got worse. Now, a recent report has been released, which included a list of more than $1 billion worth of Vancouver area property transactions back in 2016 that a confidential police intelligence study has linked to Chinese organized crime. The study of more than 1,200 luxury real estate purchases in BC's Lower Mainland in 2016 has found that more than 10% were tied to buyers with criminal records, and 95% of those transactions were believed by police intelligence to be linked to Chinese crime networks. Now, while the study only looked at property purchases in 2016, an analysis by Global News suggested that the same extended crime network may have laundered about $5 billion in Vancouver area homes since 2012. At the center of the money laundering ring is a powerful China-based gang called the Big Circle Boys. Its top-level kingpins are the international drug traffickers who are profiting most of from Canada's deadly fentanyl crisis that's been sweeping across the country. Now, the crime network, according to police intelligence sources, is a fluid coalition of hundreds of wealthy criminals in Metro Vancouver, including gangsters, industrialists, financial fugitives, and corrupt officials from China. Now, they are involved in drug import and production schemes, casino money laundering, real estate money laundering, prostitution, and financial crimes. The sources said. The common link among them is an underground banking scheme in which Chinese VIP gamblers and gangster associates secretly transfer money between China and Richmond, BC, in order to fund fentanyl imports and trafficking in Canada. Now, BC lottery casinos are an important conduit in the underground transactions, but the money laundering through gambling is minuscule compared to the amounts going through real estate. Now, the findings come amid Metro Vancouver's housing affordability crisis, in which middle-class families have been basically priced out of the city. Many of these properties were left empty and bought on paper by the spouses and children of suspected criminals. Investigators were surprised that some convicted drug trafficking criminals didn't even conceal their property purchases. Even so, the RCMP just doesn't have the resources to tackle so many suspected money laundering transactions in Vancouver, a source said. Meanwhile, home prices in Vancouver have tripled since 2005. And now it appears that the provincial government's probe into the suspected criminal activities has been stalled. One of the biggest money laundering investigations in Canadian history won't actually go to trial because the case has collapsed. BC Attorney General David Eby said he was informed that the high-profile case into suspected drug money circulating in Vancouver area casinos had collapsed. He said the investigation by the RCMP, which began in 2015, was set to go to trial in January, according to the CBC. Now, it's unclear to provincial officials why the federal government stayed or discontinued the criminal charges, Eby said. He said something obviously went terribly wrong. We have to figure out why this is happening, why it is that we appear unable to prosecute these criminal activities. This is a crisis for our province, said Eby, who has pleaded with the federal government for resources and a coordinated national approach to combating money laundering. He said, it's a disturbing signal that a prosecution of this magnitude collapses. Now, the federal government allegedly didn't even let the provincial government know about the case collapsing, with Eby learning about the news through a Vancouver Sun article. Still, going forward, the province will concentrate on securing an explanation for the decision from the Federal Prosecution Service and the RCMP, plus lessons to be learned for future money laundering cases. Or, as John Horgan put it, David Eby's working with Bill Blair, who is the federal minister responsible for gang violence and corporate crime, and we're trying to figure out, first of all, why were the charges stayed, and what steps can we take to ensure that it doesn't happen again. Now, to be sure, neither Horgan or Eby has completely ruled out calling a public inquiry with power to blame policy, regulatory, and especially political failures with the federal government. So why exactly is the federal government stalling on helping curb such blatant and dangerous criminal activity? Is it because of a frosty relationship between Horgan and Trudeau because of the stalling of the Trans Mountain pipeline? Is it a lack of money from Ottawa, given that they're putting us into a bigger deficit all the time? Or is it something worse, that the federal government is somehow profiting off of the money laundering itself? At the end of the day, we don't really know. We just have to ask the questions. One thing we do know is that two high-profile Brampton Liberal MPs may be under investigation from the RCMP for alleged gambling debts and corruption. Now, the city of Brampton has asked the RCMP to look at a multi-million-dollar land deal after confidential information on the transaction was passed to local Liberal MPs Navdeep Bains and Raj Grewal, sources confirmed Friday. Now, the information was received by Bains, who is the Economic Development Minister, and Grewal, who recently announced that he would resign because of a gambling addiction and related debts, including the price that the city had offered the Ontario government for the piece of land, which was about $3.3 million. Now, after talks between the municipality and the province broke down, a local company called Gorway Heaven Inc. bought the property for a similar amount and then later sold it to the city for $4.4 million, according to two different sources. Now, Gorway Heaven appears to actually have liberal ties, with at least one of its directors taking part in the Prime Minister's ill-fated trip to India earlier this year. About half of the directors have made two or more donations each to the Federal Liberal Party. Now, Raj Grewal later issued a lengthy statement and video explaining that he was quitting the Liberal caucus and taking a leave of absence, but he's actually rethinking whether to actually resign his Brampton East seat. Now, Grewal indicating that he had repaid millions of dollars he owed friends and families because of a gambling problem, he said that he had made his ill-advised earlier statement about resigning while in a highly emotional state. In an 11-minute video statement, Grewal said that he began playing the card game Blackjack in 2016 at Quebec's Casino du Lac Lémy, which is connected to the hotel where he lived while in Ottawa. Now, this habit caused him to borrow millions of dollars, which he said was solely from friends and family to continue to fuel the gambling. He earlier said back on the 22nd that he would resign as MP, but he's going to actually put off that decision. Now, he said that every loan was in the form of a check and that the debts have been paid. He apologized to his family, saying that they bailed him out. "This has nothing to do with anything sinister, except to feed my own addictions," said Grewal. Unfortunately for him, it's nothing to do sinister, except for the fact that he was a member of the House of Commons Financial Committee until September 19th. In that role, he actually helped review the proceeds of crime, money laundering, and the Terrorist Financing Act, and question law enforcement officials about Canada's compliance system. Now, NDP MP Peter Julian, who is one of the vice chairs of the Finance Committee, told Global News prior to Chief Party Whip Mark Holland's comments on Grewal resigning that he believed that the Liberals must have known about Grewal's gambling problem when they moved him off the committee back in September. He said, quote, "Obviously, the Liberals knew months ago. They wouldn't have moved him off without knowing this." Now, at a meeting of the Finance Committee back on June 20th, he actually asked Finance Canada's Annette Ryan, quote, "Would there be a scenario in which a financial institution would provide what they think is a suspicious transaction to FinTrack? Then FinTrack would launch an investigation, but the individual account holder would never know what is taking place." Now, FinTrack is the intelligence agency that counters money laundering and other financial crimes, so it appears from this question that it puts him in a complete conflict of interest, given that he had a bunch of suspicious transactions through his gambling debts. Now, in his statement, Mr. Grewal said that his questions were based on input from the Library of Parliament and his staff. He said, quote, "To infer that my motivations were unethical, or that I was using a chance opportunity to figure out if FinTrack was aware of my gambling, is to stretch reality and take the situation completely out of context. However, the questions still remain, and, you know, looking at the motivations is hard to know what actually happened." Now, Grewal, as of today, is no longer a member of the Liberal caucus. It's unknown if he resigned voluntarily or if he was actually forced out. In his November 22nd post, he said that he would be resigning for personal and medical reasons. But now we know that it's because he's under investigation because of his gambling addiction. So here we have a Liberal MP with a gambling problem who is in charge of a committee to investigate money laundering. So this sounds like a pretty clear-cut case of corruption and conflict of interest, and he should resign his MP seat immediately. And it's pretty clear that though there is a huge problem brewing in BC over casinos, that the federal government won't help us on it. And the media hasn't really made the link between the BC money laundering problem and the Trudeau government's own corruption within its MPs. But we here at Western Context will always connect the dots that the media won't.
And the dots here that are being connected are that, yes, there is a money laundering problem in BC with China, but maybe the Liberal government is also having some trouble with one of its MPs and whatnot. And if it was shining the light on BC and it didn't shine the light on its own MP soon enough, that would make them look bad, and they can't have that heading into an election year.
Yeah, exactly. And the fact that there's been lots of talk about Gruol, there's been lots of talk about the BC Casinos, but there hasn't really been much of a link in between. And knowing that the federal government stayed the charges and the investigation into the money laundering is really quite something. It almost seems like if the investigation was going to find out something that the federal government didn't like. At the end of the day, we don't really know the answers after all, because the investigation didn't go through and it didn't go to trial. So all we're left to do is ask the questions and try and figure out what happened. But at the end of the day, it's pretty clear that in this case, we had that Liberal MP that clearly should be resigning because of something that put him in a huge conflict of interest, and the media isn't really going after him on.
Yeah, and you know, we also have the issue that the case in BC in particular revolves around China, and it seems as though that many Western governments are reluctant to tighten the screws on China when it comes to that case, whether it be Chinese organized crime in this case, because, you know, when you look at the way corporations are set up in China, every corporation set up in China, and you need a corporation to do this level of money laundering, needs to be approved by the Chinese government. So the Chinese government is going to have to come into it at some point. And with a government that's trying and been trying to open trade relationship with China, they're not going to want to push China in a way that might be unsatisfactory towards those trade negotiations and the like. So that could also be playing in a factor as well. And it's really unfortunate, because the people who are getting hurt by this at the end of the day are the people who are being forced out of the Vancouver area.
Yeah, and not just that, but the crime that can be induced into and one of Canada's like best cities in North America. I would say that Vancouver is a very beautiful place to live, but if organized crime is able to continue to flourish there, it's not going to be beautiful for much longer. And it doesn't matter how beautiful it is if you can't afford to live there to begin with. And the fact that this problem has still been going on a year later after that report that we detailed back in October of 2017, and the problem has just gotten worse, and it seems like the federal government is stalling on this. We're left with no answers as to how we can actually solve the problem. And I think that the government saying one thing about this and doing another is just another example of the doublespeak, which is actually our word of the week, is doublespeak. Now, this was a word that was originating from George Orwell's book 1984. Doublespeak refers to a language that deliberately obscures, disguises, distorts, or reverses the meaning of words. Now, doublespeak may take the form of euphemisms, such as downsizing for layoffs, or servicing the target for bombing, or in which case it's primarily meant to make the truth sound more palatable. And I think we see this a lot in both our firing line story, where government is saying one thing and doing another, especially when we have the Alberta story, where Amarjeet Sohi is saying one thing that he agrees with the protesters, yet his government is doing another thing on pipelines. And the fact that the government's, when it comes to GM as well as the migrants, they say one thing and do another as well. So it's pretty clear that in this case, that doublespeak is our word of the week.
Yeah, and it also applies greatly to the media as well. In this case, you know, sometimes the media says one thing, but in reality, they could say something else and it would entirely change the rationale of the story behind it. And, you know, that could have been the case with Sohi's as well, in particular when it was reported that he agreed with the protesters out there. So doublespeak is indeed a good word of the week. And if you want, you know, to find full show notes and follow along with everything that we've been talking about, see all of the source supplementals links for our stories this week, you can do that in our full show notes at westerncontext.ca. You can also subscribe to the podcast on any number of podcast listeners out there, iTunes, Google Play Podcasts, practically anything. You can figure out how to do that at westerncontext.ca/subscribe. And we're also on Twitter and Facebook at Western Context, where we post all the stories that we're looking at throughout the entirety of the week. So with that being said, we'll see you next week for another episode of Western Context.
And we'll always make sure to look through all of the news of the week to make sure that the media and cut out all the bias and sensationalism that the media doesn't want to talk about and decides to showcase in other means, and to make sure that you have the context needed to put yourself on the right side of the news. With that said, we'll see you next week for another episode of Western Context.